From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Nearly 1,500 people died in the U.S. yesterday, deaths related to the coronavirus, the deadliest day of the summer. And Dr. Michael Osterholm says the only way to save lives and the economy is another lockdown, or as he says, stay-at-home orders. Dr. Osterholm is a trusted voice, director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. His op-ed in the New York Times, written with Neil Kashkari, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minnesota, was eye-catching, titled, "Here's How to Crush the Virus Until Vaccines Arrive." He basically says the U.S. wasn't as strict as Europe to start and then opened up too soon. We should have waited until there were one case per 100,000 people. Instead, we opened up when there are about seven new cases per 100,000 people. Michael, Dr. Osterholm, have I got that right?
That's correct. We did. But then in addition, when we did unlock, we just let the floodgates open. We didn't bring it back gradually like these other countries did to make sure that they had it under control. It's not that they haven't had problems. But if you look at what's happened since then, they've been putting out brush fires, not our ongoing kind of super coronavirus fire. And Neil's major contribution to this piece was looking at it from an economic standpoint. If we continue to see these case numbers rise come Labor Day, when we have all of our colleges come back into session, high schools back into session, we're going to see a major explosion of cases that will spill over into the public. And then we're, of course, also heading into the fall heating season, which will only accentuate the problem. So what Neil's data shows is that, in fact, from an economic standpoint, we will have much less injury to the economy by basically locking it down and allowing us to bring it back. If you look at the GDP of those countries that have locked down hard and then brought back their economies, they're substantially better than what's happened in the United States. We also laid out in that op-ed piece, we do have to take care of those who lose their jobs. We have to take care of small businesses. We have to take care of city and state governments that have suffered measurably. And as Neil laid out in that piece, because of the major increase in savings that's happened with the result of the pandemic, this can be financed with U.S. dollars. It would be an investment in ourselves.
Because just like a lot of us aren't spending any money, we're sitting in our homes, many people are, the government has also been saving money. There's money.
There is the money. That's the whole point. We can do this. It's an investment in us.
Well, Dr. Osterholm, a couple questions here. First of all, when you say lockdown, which we've been using that word loosely, you really say that what you're talking about is a stay at home. So some of us saw this in parts of the country. You stayed home unless you had something essential to do, like go to a store or go to a doctor's appointment. And essential workers obviously could go do their jobs. So you're not talking about even the complete lockdown that we saw in, you know, Italy.
We're not. But we do it very different, though. For example, in Minnesota, the best estimate from the groups that study who is an essential worker would say that less than 40% of the workforce in our state is an essential worker, yet 80% were designated essential workers back last spring. So, you know, we really kind of did a slowdown, not a lockdown. And so what we would need to do for 6 weeks is get it so that we stop transmission.
Okay. We spoke earlier with former CDC director, Dr. Tom Frieden. He doesn't think we should do another lockdown. He said the first lockdown was done for too long and too early in many places. It generated this huge resentment we're dealing with now. He wants to see a more targeted approach. Are you speaking about a targeted approach as well? I mean, are certain states targeted and others not?
Absolutely. I mean, look at New York. They have had a flat line in new cases for the last 3 months. In terms of, you know, the idea that we did it for too long, what we did is we didn't do it well enough. And we understand the resentment, and we do understand that in some areas of the country where they had no known cases and they were told to shut down, that didn't make much sense. Now, however, all the red and blue states have begun to dissolve into a COVID color state. All the counties are doing the same thing. Right here in Minnesota, some of the highest rates of transmission we're seeing is in rural Minnesota. The bottom line is it's like the old oil fram commercial from decades ago. You can pay me now or you'll pay me later.
Dr. Osterholm, a kind of a tough question. Is it possible that we Americans just aren't as noble as Italians? I mean, we saw them hunkered down in their apartments, banging their pots and pans at night. They were not going out at all. Here we have, you know, sheriffs in Florida, at least one, banning the use of masks. He says they don't work. You know, what do you do when this has become so politicized?
Well, you know, as a scientist, I can just give you the best science facts about what we can do to make it much less of a problem and how to help support our economy. But the bottom line is we do have good news in that there is a lot we can do to really suppress the transmission of this virus in this country if we elect to do so. If we don't do anything, the virus will exert its will on us, and it will extract one hell of a price.
Dr. Michael Osterholm, Director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let's go now to Lebanon, where we're learning about the political and economic state of the country after that massive explosion last week killed more than 200 people there. Protesters in Beirut argue the tragedy is just the latest example of government corruption and negligence, and they're demanding major changes. Sasha Fahmy is a doctor who's part of the group The Shakeup, formed to respond to people's needs after the explosion, and she's also attended some of the demonstrations. She joins us on Skype from Beirut. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Sasha, we've been hearing a lot about how difficult life is there, how difficult it has been for a very long time. One example, people are unable to get their basic needs met. You give an example of people not being able to get money out of their bank accounts. You're experiencing this firsthand. How bad is it?
It's terrible. And I have to say, I am incredibly lucky because I am both Lebanese and American. I live between New York City and Beirut. We now effectively cannot withdraw any of our money from the bank. A friend of mine just yesterday was told he had to wait 5 days to withdraw from his bank account, even in Lebanese pounds. And this is something that is unprecedented because people have lost their life savings. And at the same time that this was happening, billions of dollars have been taken outside of the country by owners of banks and by the politicians themselves, which is just fueling the fire, if you will. People are enraged. And I think much of this rage comes from the economic despair here.
I want to ask you more about your experience when that explosion happened last week. Where were you?
So I was in my apartment. I was standing in my kitchen and suddenly felt the room begin to shake. And I was on the phone at the time with my partner, and we both assumed it was an earthquake. So I ran to the doorway. And as I did that, there was the second explosion and all of my windows and doors shattered. And our first gut response was, this is an attack, because in Beirut, when something like this happens, you assume it's war. And we were both sort of stunned for a second and thought, okay, we need to get underground somehow. Where can we go? And truly, those first 15 to 20 minutes were the most terrifying of my life, because we didn't know when the next attack would come. The first thing I did was call my mother in New York City to tell her that I love her. And the second was to look for my kitten, which still, a week later, is not coming out from under the bed because he's so traumatized. But all things considered, I had a much, much, much smoother, sort of easy experience because so many people, over 300,000 people, are displaced from their homes. I mean, there are entire neighborhoods of our city that are completely demolished.
You've been a big part of the protests there. You were actually tear gassed during one of the protests.
I don't consider myself to be an organizer or anything of the sort, but I am present at the protests because I feel like it is my obligation to do so. And yes, this past Saturday, I was in Martyr Square along with tens of thousands of other Lebanese people and non-Lebanese people as well, who were protesting against the government's corruption in the wake of the explosion. And really, almost immediately upon our arrival, which was in the late afternoon around 4 p.m., we started to be hit by just indiscriminate tear gas canisters. And the figures are something like 768, I believe, people were injured, and 153 of them had to be transported to hospitals. I myself was treating people who had tear gas injuries on the ground. So it was a really terrifying show of force, and particularly just devastating given the events of the past week.
You're also a doctor, and like the rest of the world, Lebanon is dealing with the coronavirus in addition to the thousands of people who have been injured from this explosion. Are you overwhelmed?
The hospital systems here are completely overwhelmed. In the wake of the explosion, things have gotten far worse. Every day, cases are going up, and we simply do not have the infrastructure to care for people. I am really disheartened and terrified by what will happen here.
Sasha, what's next? What's next for you? What's next for the protesters?
I don't know. I mean, I feel like I have an obligation to be here. My parents emigrated to the States many years ago and made tremendous sacrifices in order for me to, you know, go to medical school and become a physician. And now I feel like I have an obligation to my fellow countrymen and women here in order to do what I can to make Lebanon a better and more equitable place.
That's Sasha Fahmy. She's a doctor there and part of the group, The Shakeup, in Lebanon. Sasha, thank you so much for this.
Thank you.
After civil rights icon John Lewis was buried, efforts increased to rename the bridge he led 600 African Americans over in 1965 to peacefully protest for voting rights. The bridge in Selma, Alabama, is named after a white supremacist senator, Edmund Pettus. Thousands have signed a petition to name it after Lewis, who was just 25 when he and the marchers were beaten by state troopers, his skull fractured, a day that became known as Bloody Sunday. But there are many in Selma who revere John Lewis. They followed him, and they want the name to stay the way it is. Linda Lowry is one of them. She was just 14 in 1965 when she was beaten and got stitches of her own. A warning, as we hear her story, we'll hear racist language that she heard then and in her life. It may be upsetting for some. Linda, thank you so much for giving us your time.
Thank you for having me, Robin.
You were 14. What happened to you?
On that Sunday, we were marching two abreast, led by the late Congressman John Lewis and the late Hosea Williams. So all of the state troopers and sheriff deputies, and as we knelt, that's when I felt someone grab me in the back of my collar, jerking me out of a kneeling position. Well, when he jerked me back, his fan just happened to hit my mouth, and my mouth wasn't nonviolent, so I bit him on his hand. I heard the word nigger twice, and he hit me twice in my forehead, and I managed to get up and start running into a cloud of tear gas. And this man, a sheriff's deputy, was running behind me, hitting me.
Hitting you with what, Linda? With a baton?
They had things like little baseball bats. I passed out, and when I woke up, I started running back across the bridge. When I got to the Selma side, I stopped in my tracks because I saw this man holding my baby sister, and she looked like she was dead. He said she had just fainted. She was 11 years old at the time. So I grabbed her hand and I started running. And when I got to the hospital, I remember this white doctor. He had a needle in his hand. The next thing I remember, it was about 10:30 at night, and I was walking up those 10 steps to our back door with my daddy. I had 7 stitches over my right eye and 28 in the back of my head. Mm. And that's when I became an angry 14-year-old, angry at the governor, Governor George Wallace. And I was determined then that I was going to be out there and in his face as long as I needed to be to make change.
What an incredible story, Linda. Just 14 years old. And you'd actually met with John Lewis. You were taught by him. Just tell us a little bit about that.
John was always quiet, no-nonsense person, but it was like E.F. Hutton. When John spoke, you stopped and listened. I love and admire him, but I don't want the name of my bridge changed.
Well, can you explain that, Linda? Because he taught you nonviolent protest. You followed him across that bridge. You loved him. Why not change the name to honor him?
To honor John would be to take the signatures on that petition to Congress and have them restore the 1965 Voting Rights Act. And if we change the name to anything, it would be a whitewash of our history.
That protest, that Bloody Sunday, led right to the Voting Rights Act. There were requirements for certain southern states. The Supreme Court overturned that. You're saying, let's restore that. That would honor him. But what do you say to people who just really still can't understand this, to leave the name of an avowed racist on a bridge?
I still say that we, on March 7th, 1965, we took the sting out of that name. If you really want to do something, then find out what Selma is, what it needs, and help Selma that way.
I think it was your sister, Joanne Bland, who said, you know, Pettus is rolling in his grave every time we walk across that bridge.
Yes.
Because every year there's a commemoration, and every year he knows he lost. But is part of it also that there were so many local people? I'm not saying you want a bridge named after you or even after Amelia Boynton, who was beaten unconscious. But John Lewis would be the first to say he came from outside Selma to help you guys organize. There are so many people who had been doing the work in Selma.
Our blood and tears is embedded in the cement of that bridge. And John himself said he didn't get beat across the John Lewis Bridge, and he got beat across the Edmund Pettus Bridge. And if there had not been that Confederate history, there wouldn't have been a need for civil rights or voting rights history.
Yeah. What a trauma for a 14-year-old to be in that moment. We are so much more conscious of all of that because of John Lewis's passing. I'm wondering if you've had to relive it. I mean, this might be difficult for you.
For 40 years, Robin, I could not talk about the things that happened to me, or I couldn't even articulate my feelings. And finally, writing a memoir, Turning 15 on the Road to Freedom, my story of the 1965 voting rights movement as told to Elspeth Leacock and Susan Buckley, it took them about 8 years to get my story out of me. Now I can talk about things, and I used the words that was used on us when the sheriff's deputy hit me. He called me a nigger. I used those words because that's the words that were used. But I also ask people to think about how an 8-year-old girl felt when her daddy took her to town to get her a pair of Sunday dress shoes. And they go into a store, and this little white girl, younger than me, asks my daddy, "What you want, nigger?" Mm-hmm. And I looked up at my daddy, and the look that was in his eyes still haunts me today, because it was a look of helplessness. Before we knew anything, we knew that white people didn't like us and Black people in Selma, Alabama. At the age of 7, my mother died And the older people said she wouldn't have died if she hadn't been colored. I knew that white people didn't like black people then. But then I found out when my mother died that they hated black people. So I made a vow at 7 years old that when I got big, I was going to change things, that nobody would ever have to grow up without a mommy again because of the color of her skin. I didn't know that getting big meant I would hear Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. speak at the age of 13. Dr. King said you could get anybody to do anything but steady, loving confrontation. I distinctively heard him say, "Linda, you can get anybody to do anything with steady, loving confrontation." And that's how I have lived my life. And going to jail 9 times before my 15th birthday, then marching on that bridge on March 7th, getting beaten, just reinforced me that I could be a vessel for change. And when we win this fight this time, it will be the end of our fighting.
Linda Lowry, thank you so, so much for speaking with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
The number of Americans filing for state unemployment benefits dropped below 1 million for the first time since March. But there are still more than 28 million Americans on the unemployment rolls. And for more, let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. And Ali, to put these numbers into context, in late March, 6.9 million Americans filed for unemployment. Is this a sign of progress?
Yeah, I would definitely say it is. It's still, however, historic. Back in 1982, we had a weekly high of $695,000. So 695,000 people claiming for unemployment benefits. So we are still way above that. This week, it's very, very slow, this recovery. So far in 21 weeks, 56.2 million Americans have sought unemployment aid, and we don't know when this is going to end. There's also something unique about today. It's Black Women's Equal Pay Day. So this is the symbolic date for how far into the year Black women have to work to earn the same pay that white men earned in the previous year. So African American unemployment is still higher than it is. So it's a problem all around.
That's really interesting. I want to ask you about something else. So according to the Labor Department, in July, 1.8 million jobs were brought back. That was fewer jobs than expected. I mean, when you look at that number and this new unemployment figure, what exactly do you see?
Yeah, so it's hard to sort of make sense of all the numbers that come out. So let me give it to you this way. 22 million jobs were lost between February and April. That was sort of the beginning, the first rush of layoffs. 9.3 million of the 22 million jobs have been brought back. That's according to the Labor Department. Then we saw a new wave of unemployment. So we're now looking at more than half of all American households having lost income since March 13th, right? That's the date most people think of as the beginning of the closures. Over a quarter of Americans are struggling with housing insecurity, which means they're not quite sure they can make their rent or their mortgage, or there might be a foreclosure going on or a eviction proceeding. So if you even it across all Americans, we're looking at an income drop in annual earnings of 10%. But again, some people haven't lost much income at all, and other people have lost 100% of their income. So the numbers are staggering, but there's no way to paint this as good.
Ali, I mean, this question I'm about to ask you is one that I think everyone's thinking about, and no one has like the answer, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Nearly 1,500 people died yesterday of the coronavirus in this country. I mean, it's the highest single-day death toll since mid-May. the virus is not under control here. What does this mean for the economy looking forward?
Well, so we think of recessions in shapes of letters, right? We talk about V-shaped, U-shaped, W-shaped, and it's just a chart, right? It goes down. Does it hang around for a while or does it go up? We're not going to see the upward trend until something is fixed. Either the transmission rates become lower, the death rates become lower, or we get a treatment or a vaccine. And there's just, despite what the president says about there being a vaccine by November and Vladimir Putin saying there's already a vaccine, that's not actually true. And most experts say the earliest we will get something is the beginning of 2021. It may be well into 2021. So we are looking at a long bottom to this recession and then subsequently a recovery.
Ali Velshi is MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. As always, thank you.
Thank you.
Artist Keith Morris Washington's new series of portraits, mostly black and white life-size drawings, is called Black Lives. And that's what you see. A woman sitting on a chair, two teen boys walking with their backpacks, a man smiling, his arms crossed. But they become so much more when you find out that these are people that Keith met in places, as he says, where black folks have been killed by cops. It started with a road trip in 2016 to see many of these places, Oakland, Ferguson. He met, photographed, and later sketched the vibrant people who still live there. The exhibit is currently on display by appointment at the Concord Center for the Visual Arts in Concord, Massachusetts, but we're going to have many of the portraits right at hereandnow.org. You can go there right now and see what we're talking about when we say that they are so full of life. As we welcome Keith Morris Washington, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Now, first I want to say that this going to places isn't new for you. Your series, Within Our Gates, showed lynching sites around the country as they are today. What inspired that series?
That's a great question. It came about while I was in grad school. I started it as my thesis project. And I've always loved American landscape painting. And one of the things that I was always intrigued with is that they show the American landscape is this peaceful, serene place. And of course, in the middle of the 1800s, this country was anything but serene. There was a civil war going on. My thinking was, I love landscape. I want to be a part of this tradition of American landscape painting. But I felt like my paintings needed to show a different aspect of the landscape.
Well, we read you told the Boston Globe, after the horrific bombing at the Alfred P. Murrah Building in Oklahoma, when the phrase domestic terrorism began to be used, your thinking was that blacks in the United States have suffered domestic terrorism for, you know, well over 100 years.
More than that, from the moment we were stolen and brought to these shores.
Before that. So that's the series on landscapes where lynching took place as the landscape is now. The new series. This is Black Lives. People you just happened to meet at places where black lives were also taken.
Yes. Well, with the Black Lives series, I was inspired by the Black Lives Matter and Say Her Name movements. You might recall, I think it was in around 2016 or so, that lots of students on college and university campuses were taking them over and putting forward demands to various administrations to address the inequities in education, as well as the omission of black folks from the curriculum. So I teach at the Massachusetts College of Art and Design, and our students did in fact take over a town hall meeting and put forward some demands to our administration. And I just was inspired, motivated by several of those things and knew that I had to make a contribution to Black Lives Matter, Say Her Name movement. And being an artist, what I landed on was making these slightly larger than life-size portraits of just ordinary black folks. The previous series, Within Our Gates, is about memorializing the victims of white violence. In this case, I did not want to continue to place black folks in the role of victim, but rather I wanted to honor these people who managed to live and survive despite living in these horrendous circumstances.
And again, say her name. The call to say out loud the names of women killed: Breonna Taylor, Corinne Gaines, Sandra Bland, found dead in a jail cell. Where are the places that you've gone?
I started in Oakland, went down to L.A., Vegas. I think to Texas was probably my next stop for Sandra Bland's place. And as I got off the highway and was headed towards Prairie View A&M, where Sandra was also headed, I realized just how close she was to the university when she got pulled over and arrested by the police officer. She was literally within a quarter mile of being safe. So it just began what ended up being a very challenging emotional journey for me.
And just to remind people, Sandra Bland pulled over, minor traffic issue. The next thing she knows, she's in jail, where she dies. On her way to Prairie View A&M, where you took pictures of students and staff and then painted them. You know, it's obvious why this would be emotional, or why it would be emotional when you went to Oakland, where Oscar Grant was killed at Fruitvale Station by transit police in 2009. But can you put it into words why it was emotional for you, for instance, to be where Sandra Bland was pulled over and to see these students?
Well, in Sandra Bland's case, because I realized how close she was to safety. I suspect if she had made it onto campus, she would be alive today.
Well, and when we look at the pictures that you've done out of this, for instance, of students, I mean, they are so full of life.
So, yeah, once I was talking to folks, that was great. I'm an artist. I'm not an interviewer like you. So my conversations were rather brief. I described what the project I had in mind was, and I asked them if I could just take their pictures to make these drawings. They didn't want to share contact information. They were just willing to lend me their images to make these drawings from.
And as I look at them, and again, people can see them here now.org, they make me smile. But then, you know, they do make me tear up a little to think that a life was also taken right in the same place. Is that the point, to show life when life has been taken?
Yes. You know, I just really want to extol and honor these folks, my folks, our folks who live in these places. We often only see them as these abstract images on the television screen because some tragedy has happened.
Well, now on exhibit because of COVID-19 by appointment, but what's happened in the exhibit, we understand, is that you have groupings of four paintings suspended from the ceiling, so they form a square. And then, feels like reverentially, you've placed items inside the square that seem in memory of some of the lives that were taken. You know, loose cigarettes for Eric Garner, Staten Island, selling loose cigarettes. Skittles for Trayvon Martin. Tell us more about that.
And Arizona iced tea, yes. As I came up with the idea to suspend them from the ceiling rather than having them on the wall, sort of four drawings making kind of a box, and then to place this article in the middle of them to honor the person who actually life was taken. And it feels to me almost like these drawings are there to protect the spirit of, in this case, Trayvon Martin and Eric Garner.
And in other cases.
Yes. You know, once I get four more of these done, perhaps a toy gun for Tamir Rice.
The 12-year-old child playing with a toy gun when he was shot and killed. I have to think that lynching sites, the sites of the taking of unarmed Black lives, this has got to be emotionally ringing across the board. And I'm wondering if part of it is, I mean, obviously you're not going to paint over that pain, but does this alleviate it somewhat?
No. Actually, no. For me as an artist, I cannot describe with words the joy I have in the making, in the process of making. So, and again, with the Within Our Gates series, they are memorials and historical place markers, right? So they're memorializing the victims of lynching, and also to add them to the lexicon of our history that we need to teach just like anything else. And with the Black Lives series, and the title is Black Lives and then omission marks, because it is not clear to me yet that Black lives matter in this country. And hopefully, as people come in and view these drawings, they will be closer to the realization that, yes, absolutely, these lives matter as much as the viewer's life matters. But the pain of living in a white supremacist culture, that doesn't go away.
That's artist Keith Morris Washington talking about his new exhibit, Black Lives, ... at the Concord Center for the Visual Arts. And again, for pictures, go to hereandnow.org. Keith, thank you.
Thank you so much.
San Francisco is now home to the world's first transgender district, which spans four blocks in the city's Tenderloin neighborhood. Aria Saeed is the founder and executive director of the Compton Transgender Cultural District, and she joins me now to talk about the importance of it. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes. So, Aria, you moved from Portland, Oregon to San Francisco when you were 19 years old, and you had a lot of expectations of what life would look like as a trans person there. But reality did not exactly meet those expectations. What did you discover, and what in your discoveries made you decide that a district was needed?
I, like so many Black trans people, came here for refuge, because no other place in the United States felt safe. And what was debilitating was that I never saw any other Black trans people who were employed or stably housed, et cetera, right? And so even coming to San Francisco, I would interview for jobs and people would start laughing as I entered the room. Or I wouldn't get hired because I was trans. And it was very obvious that that was happening. And I found that me and so many of my Black trans women sisters in the Tenderloin, we had no other option but to engage in survival sex work. And so all these years later, in founding the district, I think we are facilitating a conversation and what I believe to be a radical solution in addressing our disparity.
Let's talk a little bit more about that solution. So this district is not only a cultural safe space, it also serves as a resource. What programs do you all provide, and how has the pandemic impacted the ability to continue these programs?
So our effort is really about evaluating ways to cultivate long-term stability and empowerment of trans people. And so we are in developing first our community center, which will launch in 2021. It's been delayed, of course, due to COVID. And then we are also preparing to really launch an economic empowerment program that provides seed grants and sort of fast track them into entrepreneurship. And so we figure if the world won't hire us, then we have to hire ourselves.
I want to talk with you about some politics now. So the Trump administration has rolled back protections for transgender people. Most recently, a newly proposed housing and urban development rule that could allow homeless shelters to turn away transgender people based on their physical appearance. Your thoughts on these rolling back of protections?
I think what is so frustrating for me is that for many people, I think now that they have more access to trans people and trans stories and whatnot, there can be this sort of sense that we are like taking over, that we are like actually a huge population. We're actually not, right? And so I think the reality with the Trump administration, the gatekeeping of homeless shelters and giving cause and agency to these social service providers who should be trying to help every single person that they can, and giving them license to discriminate is an act of violence. I also think that President Trump is highlighting what I believe to be America's subconscious, which is that there is a way in our culture that intensely discriminates against trans people. And I think we see that more often than we care to talk about.
Another political question for you. So Senator Kamala Harris who's been chosen as the VP candidate for presumptive Democratic nominee Joe Biden, has vowed to be an advocate for the LGBT community in her bid for the White House. But some are skeptical because of her record as California's attorney general. During that time, she defended the state's Department of Corrections, a decision to deny reassignment surgery for some inmates in the state prison. Your thoughts on this as we move towards the general election in November?
Well, I mean, I don't trust politicians to have a perfect track record in relationship to marginalized communities, because there are a series of compromises that I imagine happen when you are in office. Having met Senator Harris here in San Francisco during her presidential campaign and talking with her, I believe that she and her staff are evolving in what it looks like to advocate specifically for trans people. The only thing that we can do is continue to hold accountability and continue to demand that they expand their promise and framework of what LGBT equality looks like, and specifically for transgender people.
That's Aria Saeed, founder and executive director of the Compton's Transgender Cultural District in San Francisco. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.